You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNT podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Dauphin. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is Wesley falls in love with the new leader of a war-torn planet. That's lovely, isn't it? This is the 10th episode of Season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and it originally aired on the 20th of February 1989. It was written by Scott Rubenstein and Leonard Mlodinow, and directed by Rob Bowman. Guest stars include Diana Mondale as Dr. Pulaski, Paddy Edwards as Anya, Jamie Hubbard as Celia, Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan, Cole Meany as Chief O'Brien, Peter Neptune as the most buff security guard I have ever seen, Aaron. Machen Amick as the teenage girl, Cindy Sorensen as furry animal, spoilers, and Jennifer Barlow as Ensign Gibson. So, what did we think about this episode? Now, it's been a while since I've seen this, and I don't think I've ever seen this with a critical eye. It was always an episode that I didn't love, but I think after this latest watching, I pretty much hate this episode. What about you, Lou?
Yeah, I'm as interested in a teenage love story as I am going taking Anya on a romantic date, and that's in her furry form, no less. Yeah, the ball of light, the transporter light, was pretty cool. But beyond that, yeah, it's bad. But we'll talk about it later.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let me go to my notes, because I'd like to start with the ship's log.
No, you don't, Lou. You like to start with forum feedback.
But of course I do. Why wouldn't I? Loud as a whisper is where we left off. And so we did that because there's 11 here, and there's only a few for the next two, so we decided to combine them. So you'll get two forum feedbacks next show. Be here next week. So let's start with Maress. She says, "Hi guys, I really enjoy your show on Loud as a Whisper. I wrote a short review of it myself for the Trekmate features last year, which you can read here if you like. And I will put a note to, or I'll put a link to her forum feedback. Or actually, no, it was a, let me open that. It wasn't a forum feedback. I keep forgetting that they actually do have people who write Star Trek news and features. So I have to remember that."
Yeah. I mean, I'll just, it's actually a proper essay.
Yeah.
It's a properly well thought through, well structured review of the episode. Unfortunately, unlike what we did last time.
What do you mean?
Well, which is more of just a discussion.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than an academic exercise.
Right. Some of the things we saw. Anyway, she says, "I touched on a couple points that you mentioned. Howie Seago is indeed both deaf and mute. Reva's facial expressions were supposed to mirror his telepathic connection to his chorus. This is certainly a testament to Seago's acting prowess. It would be interesting to see how it was accomplished on the set." That would be interesting. How would somebody have to explain to him sign language right now, make this expression? I'd love to see the behind the scenes. Anyway, she goes on to say, "Everything must have been choreographed to some extent. Why the choreography didn't work in Data sign language scene is puzzling." Yeah, before we go on to the rest, yeah, I agree with her, and we've touched on this, that Data's sign language scene, actually, quite honestly, I would find, if I were a person in need of sign language, I actually would find him doing that offensive. You know what I'm saying? The little itsy-bitsy spider thing he does was, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, and that's an actual sign of some kind, but I highly doubt it, and it probably just wasn't professional. Anyway, Reva was correct in insisting that Picard speak directly to him rather than addressing his course, but I felt his emotional response was overdone. Surely he'd been in such situations before. Being a mediator, he should have made allowances for others' unfamiliarity with the form of communication, and not been so easily angered. Reva is self-assured to the point of arrogance at the start. His redemption begins when he loses his course and realizes how much he needed and depended upon them. His growth is evident when with Troy's help, he learns to face his limitations and, as is said, turns his disadvantage into an advantage. I believe Geordi's scene with Pulaski is unnecessary. It was easier for Geordi to accept his blindness as being part of himself when he believed there was no possibility of a cure. When Pulaski suddenly confronts him with that option, whereas he was only looking to upgrade his visor, it's quite natural for him to want to take time to weigh the risks and benefits and to re-examine his own beliefs. As we've seen in other episodes, this was always some part of him that did not want to see as other people do. Now, he must decide whether following that inward desire is worth risks of loss of visual range involved. This doesn't negate his original conviction, as stated to Reva, though. He never says that he resents being blind. He likes who he is as a person, blind or not. Anything on that, Doc?
Yeah, no, sure. Sure. I mean, I accept the Mressa's point. I mean, I kind of didn't like the scene with Geordi and Pulaski. I thought it was just put in there because it was the kind of the issue of the week, and you know, I think she does have valid points, but I, you know, personally, I didn't need it there. So I think it's just going to be a difference of opinion here, how you read the scene, and how whether or not you think it's necessary for that story to progress in the way that it does.
Well, I think you two kind of agreed on it. You really didn't like it, and she didn't think it was necessary. And honestly, I didn't think it was necessary either. I mean, he just had this heart-to-heart, literal touching of him and Reva saying, well, I like who I am. For him to then be presented with this option that it's a one-way shot. You're either going to see like us or you're not going to see at all. I think there was no reason for it. I wish there was a different time they would have done that. Picard makes a couple of very natural mistakes in this episode. First, when he addresses a chorus instead of Reva at the start, and when he shouts at Reva as if he's raising his voice to help him understand him. In a way, this humanizes Picard for me. I love the scene where Troy convinces Reva to continue the mission. She really does shine in this episode. The way she goes about it reminds me a lot of Guinan. I wonder if Guinan would have got this scene if Whoopi Goldberg had been available. As it is, though, I like the way Marina Sirtis played it.
I mean, I must say, just jumping in here, that I felt that I was sticking my neck out a little bit here by kind of giving the thumbs up to the Troy character. But, you know, both in this post and then also later on, I think that there's a general acceptance that I think Troy does very well in this episode, and how she interacts with Reva after he's suffered the losses is good. And it's good, it's well written, it's entirely appropriate for the characters. And, you know, it's good to see Troy being used in that way.
Okay. All right. Well, she goes on to say, the effect they used when the chorus was vaporized reminded me of the Varon T disruptor from The Most Toys and the shooting of Remick in Conspiracy. It was weird. I wonder why they did an effect like that. And by the way, did you know that Marnie Moisman, who played Harmony in the chorus, is John DeLance's wife? No.
I did.
Oh, did you?
I did. I mean, there's a... It's on one of the DVDs that there's a... I think there's a chat with John DeLancey, And he mentioned that when his wife got the gig on TNG, she got killed straight away. And I think they were discussing the fact that their kids, the two actors' children were watching the television and they were asking, you know, why does mommy get killed on the TV? But, you know, but daddy keeps coming back.
Fascinating. Oh, boy. Okay. Anyway, she says, I'd give this episode a 4. It's not tops, but it's quite good. I didn't notice any engine hum in the show, though that could be because my speakers aren't the best. Generally, though, I find continual background noise in podcasts a bit distracting. Yeah, and actually, you know what I did recently is, I don't know if you heard it, Doc, but one of the last few shows, I actually just put the thing in from start to finish to see if anybody had either noticed it or didn't like it, or I was taking a gamble, and so far I haven't heard anything about it. But then again, I really haven't gone through all the feedback posts, so maybe we'll see how it goes. She says, turning into a monster post, so I don't mind if you condense what you read this feedback. Sorry, we don't.
Now you tell us.
Now you tell
now
us.
Now you tell us.
No, we don't do that. Thanks again for everything you do, guys. P.S. Howie Siegel as Reva made the cover of Def Life magazine in 1989, and she'll have a link to that as well. So that is very interesting as well, and I will check that out. But yeah, I loved Howie Siegel's reactions, so it was perfect. Okay.
Okay, so let me now move on. Let me take the next couple to give you a bit of to get your breath back.
Well, the first one you're going to read is from Pain in the Ass Q. No. Pain in the ass. No, I'm sorry. Previously in the Alpha Quadrant, Paul. What's wrong with me? Sorry, Paul. Actually, you should have seen what I called him earlier when I was talking to him on Skype. Do you want me to say it?
Okay.
I said, I just started out with, "Hey, slut, what you doing?" That's the kind of relationship we seem to have.
Under what circumstances is that appropriate?
I don't know, but it was just a way to start the conversation. That's the kind of relationship we seem to have, actually. So, he's fun. God, is he fun. Anyway, go on for Paul.
Okay. Yeah, well, from Paul, I mean, he fed back on the engine noise. And he said, love the Enterprise engine noise in the background. I would only suggest one thing, that you could add the odd console blip in the background noise once every 4 minutes or so. This would give more atmosphere to the ship. Good. But I suppose the next big one comes from...
Hey, before you go on to that, what about if I toss on a red alert once in a while? Anyway, go on.
Okay. a red alert and please evacuate to the saucer section.
Uh-huh.
Things like that.
Counselor Troy to the bridge.
Yes. Okay, let me... I'll head over to Kieran McDuff's post, our regular poster. That's not quite... Okay, not a whole lot I can add to this episode that hasn't already been covered by the podcast or Mares. I never realized that Howie Siegel was actually deaf and mute, and I was thinking about all those well-timed facial reactions when you started to discuss them. I'd love to know how they did that. This is one of those episodes that showcase Star Trek's ability to shine a light on certain aspects of our own society. The issue of addressing the wrong person are issues I've seen firsthand. I've seen it not only with foreign language interpreters addressed, but also carers. It's as if the person in the wheelchair isn't there. It's not something I like to see. Then, of course, there's how even those with some form of disability can not only contribute, but can turn that disadvantage into an advantage. I think the whole subject is focused on really well in this episode. I can't say I ever noticed anything wrong with Data's sign language, but then I wouldn't even know what to look for. I'm guessing that has always been in my mind, because spotting the one finger being raised before says it should be pretty obvious. I'll much look out for it next time I watch this one. I can't really mark this episode down for something like that, but I'm going to mark it down for me not really caring about the planet that's at war. And actually, I think I didn't particularly care about the planet either. I think that that's really much peripheral to the story. There just isn't enough time in one episode to do all the Reva storyline properly, as they did, and also to give us some type of better backstory to the planet that's at war. As such, there's no emotional connection when it looks like Reva might just abandon them. I don't feel sorry for them, even if they begged him to come back. So mainly for that reason, which is a big part of the story, Ryan, I'm only going to give this a 4 out of 5 rather than 4 marks. As for the background hum, I can't say that I noticed it. But that will be because I was driving at the time and had a background hum of my own. Not as good as the Enterprise hum, though.
Yeah. I try to keep it as low as possible to not overpower the podcast. Maybe I put too low. But, okay. Renee comes back with, I agree with all your points. I find myself not caring too much about the Solari either. That storyline existed purely to create the framework for Reva's dilemma and was never touched on again. With a few changes, I think the story would have been much better in DS9. What do you think of this synopsis? Okay, here we go. Reva and Koris come to the station to help settle the growing tensions between the Federation and the Klingon Empire. A bomb planted in the conference room kills several of the representatives, including Reva's Koris. Reva himself is injured. As he recovers, he must deal with the trauma and regain his courage to continue the negotiations. We find out Curzon had spent some time on Reva's homeworld and learned their sign language, drawing on this as well as on Curzon's experience as an ambassador to the Klingons and the wisdom of her other host. Dax learns to communicate with Reva and helps him regain his confidence. Reva finds it easier to open up to her because he and Curzon have so much in common. Worf must face his conflicting feelings about Reva and learns to accept him. Meanwhile, Odo tracks down the assassin and discovers she or he is a changeling posing as a member of the Klingon delegation sent to disrupt the negotiations. In lieu of his Koris, Reva teams up with Dax to continue the talks. Worf and Odo ask him to teach them sign language for use in covert situations. The main focus would still be on Reva dealing with issues and turning his disadvantage into an advantage. But the framework would be similar storyline with characters and species we know and care about. Yeah, interesting. And let's face it, I think Terry Farrell would have had a much better chance of actually learning the sign language than Brent probably did. That is interesting. And it involves Curzon and...
No, absolutely. I think that is. I mean, that is a good idea. I would be worried that Reva would be going after Dax. That's my main concern. The same way he went after Troy, he would probably be trying to have his way with Dax at the same time.
I know. I would have too.
And if Worf is around, maybe Worf would be. It adds a little bit more conflict between those two, maybe.
Well, that's the thing. Worf must face his conflicting feelings about Reva. Why? Because he was a ambassador to his people at one time, or now he is getting close to his girlfriend now. I mean, it depends on whether her and Worf would be together at this time. But I like the idea that Curzon was a ambassador to the Klingons, and now the Federation of Klingons have this little conflict going, so Curzon... Well, Dax has to step in. That is interesting. Dax and Reva. That would have been an interesting storyline, don't you think?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah, even Karen McDuff says you're right. It works better. It works so much better in DS9 episode. I think the overall story arc in DS9 probably helps that aspect. So, yeah, and there's more back and forth between them, but that's a very good, interesting point. Could you imagine Reva as a recurring character on DS9? No, actually. I mean, the thing is, although Reva was a very good character, I can't imagine more circumstances in one or two in the whole run where sign language would ever be necessary. Am I harsh, Doctor, or do you believe that?
No, I don't think you're being harsh. And also the whole point about Reva in the episode... I mean, loud as a whisper in this case, and also the similar setup that was proposed for DS9 is that, Reva does lose something, and it is a game changer. And that's the point which the entire story kind of hinges on. And you can't have that happen to you the following week or the following year.
Yeah.
I mean, you lose your Koris once, and you have to, relearn everything. I think it's also necessary for him to be arrogant and towards the end of, not necessarily towards the end of his career, but certainly established as a negotiator for this to really you know, to really hurt him.
He'd have to change himself to more of a strategist and tactical person and actually teach security officers sign language. But like I say, how many episodes would it actually be of benefit to be signing from one security officer to another and with Reva somewhere in the middle? Honestly, I can't see Reva as a recurring character unless they completely changed him and he just happened to be... I mean, it would be... On the other hand, what about Reva's working at Quark's or in Ops? And they have to give him a reasonable accommodation to help him work, so maybe there would be a point where he has to... Okay, here, I'm thinking this on the fly here, because I didn't read what Renee said until that moment. What about if, when he gets angry, he gives some of those signs of, you know, when he's really trying to tell you off, and some of the audience might know, and it'd be just like Klingon, learning some Klingon. Some of the audience might know, but the others won't, and they'll try and find out what he was doing when he did that. I think it'd be interesting in that respect, of how they interact with him every day. Ah, I don't know.
Okay, maybe.
Maybe, okay. Let's go on.
Should we go on to Captain Proton?
Sure.
Okay, so Captain Proton, his post. I think this episode is a perfect example how concept always overrides execution. Lou, I absolutely noticed how ridiculously fake Data's sign language was. And I agree that for an android who can learn as fast as it's shown, it was distracting to watch Brent Spiner perform those scenes. James, I too thought Troy was being genuine in her decision to mediate a peace, even if it wasn't obviously so. Also, you are correct that it doesn't matter what happens to Reva from here on out. What's important is that he chooses to stay, not the result of what that choice was. I can see how in a critical setting with a grading rubric, how the concept gets a five, and in the execution, depending on your preference of character, can range from a 2 to a 3. With objectively scores this episode a 3 to 4 out of 5.
Okay.
I thought they were all 5s out of 5.
Yeah. We're not going to stop reminding them of that, are we?
to me, when the concept is so meaningful to so many, it becomes gold. When you weigh it against the execution of that concept, the execution carries the weight of a feather. And then just Maris finishes off by saying, you make a very good point. The important thing is Reva finding the courage to run the race despite the setback and to finish stronger.
Sweet. Okay, let's see.
That was actually, what's it? That was a very, a very good, very lively feedback session.
Yes,
thanks for everyone for that.
And since they had trouble mentioning or listening, hearing the Enterprise hum in the background, do you mind if I add it to this one?
That's fine.
All right. Well, obviously, they're already
Are you going to keep making it louder and louder and louder and louder until someone complains?
No, I won't do that. There's a pretty good setting for that. I mean, just you feel it by ear whether it's right or not. Now, Reva, on the other hand, might have issues with it, but it's okay. Lame, Lou. Lame. Okay.
Okay, so we're heading off into the episode.
Of the dolphin?
Of the dolphin.
The dolphin.
Yeah.
The dolphin. So, D-A-U-L-F-A, dolphin.
Pretty much. You pronounce it as that, yeah.
Oh, okay. Everyone, we're going to talk about the dolphin. Ship's log. We're at Clofdia 3. We're going to pick up a passenger slated to be the head of state on the planet Dalid 4. It sounds like a very, very serious mission, and since time is a factor, we're going to go ahead and shut off the warp engines and do some maintenance. Yes. Since parts are not kept in engineering, Commander LaForge is sending Acting Ensign Wesley Crusher to ship stores for a needed part. You would think this would be a very easy assignment for Wesley, as there is nothing on board that could possibly disturb his focus and concentration on the mission at hand.
Well, that's pretty much a great summary of the start, right? Mm-hmm. Because that kind of, that knocks about three of my initial points out. When will we learn that we really shouldn't be making routine adjustments to the warp drive halfway through a mission? Although, in complete fairness, nothing kind of happens that we need the warp drive for. I mean, I think they want to get it over with as soon as they can. But it's not as if we're waiting for like a Romulan warbird to, to attack an outpost or something like that.
No, see, I disagree. If we're going to have the head of state on our ship, we don't know who may be gunning for her head. I'd like to get her off as quickly as possible and not be in the middle of this. I mean, we're just like a taxi waiting for somebody to come jump us. And, I don't know. I would just want to get rid of her as soon as possible. But
okay. Well, I'd want to get rid of her as soon as possible as well, as the episode goes on.
Yeah, but not at impulse speed. Let's just go as quick as we can crawl, okay? No. Okay, so, this conversation between Picard, Troy, and Worf, it goes like this. Picard says, hardly an inviting planet, even for a research establishment. And Troy says, well, I would have thought the inhabitants of Dalet 4 would send their future leader to a more hospitable planet. And Worf says, for some, security is more important than comfort. Yes, but 16 years. And I thought, aren't they pretty much giving us the hint of the whole thing behind that? Who the future leader is in her age?
Well, I actually thought that this scene before you get the guys beamed up is just exposition. It's exposition. They're trying to deliver the information to the viewer. In particular, I think Troy's scenes or lines are pretty clunky. And the idea that, yes, we are going to now beam them up. I don't understand how this person could have been here for 16 years. Well, for some people, they need security. I mean, there's a planet in the middle of nowhere without any spaceships anywhere near them. It doesn't seem to be that secure anyway. I mean, the weather's bad, but does that constitute security? I mean, you could easily just, launch a photon torpedo down to where they were staying, I would have thought.
Right. Launch a torpedo. Yeah.
And why is she the future leader? One issue that I have with this episode in general is what's this person supposed to do? I mean, she doesn't seem to want to be the leader. She seems to have been a leader because it's necessary for the script for her to become the leader. I get the impression that she doesn't want to do this. I can't imagine a situation where she would help the warring factions. It's not even clear to me whether or not is the war still going on? So has the war gone on for 16 years? While she's been trained and she's been taught and she's been kept in kindergarten also for the last 15 years or 16 years, one of the sides might have won the war. So it wouldn't have seen a very good – it's not a great plan to take a baby, to let a baby grow up for 16 years and hope that by the time she reaches adulthood, she will be in a good position to come back and sort things out, because by then all bets might be off.
Sure. Well, plus, yeah, I agree. I mean, why did she have to be a teenage girl?
Wesley's a teenage boy.
Okay, so this is all about Wesley today.
Unfortunately. Oh, and let's do this now, because she's not a teenage girl.
No, she ain't.
The actress involved she was 27 at the time or something like that. Mm-hmm. And actually now rewatching the show, she is clearly older than Wesley. I didn't see any reason why she had to be referred. I suppose they wanted her to be young because she's having to head back and to solve out the problems. But I don't know. I don't particularly find the character of the future head of state to be particularly interesting.
All right. No, I don't. But oh, that Riker, what a card. When Wesley asks, who's she? He says, I think she's a governess. No, the girl. Well, she ain't going to have time for you. She's got to be in bed by 1400 hours. I know. It just... Obviously, Here's the thing. I mean, is it just happenstance? Because obviously they're not human. Because she asks, what species are you? Human. Good. Ready to bring us aboard. And, you know, and then they come aboard as an old female human and a teenage female human. So obviously it was just happenstance for Wesley that she happened to be around his age and not some blob of goo.
Yeah. But by the way, that explanation of why they have to turn into, like, you know, humans is just terrible as well, because we've seen lots of aliens in Star Trek. Most of the aliens are humanoid, so they look like humans with a few minor variants. Now, we very rarely see a large number of other alien races that look similar. I know the Vulcans and the Romulans and, you know, the various offshoots of them, they have like their own little family. But we don't exactly see, like, you know, a large number of different races of, you know, of Tellarites or anything like that.
Right.
Now, had they got to the planet and they said, you know, what species are you? And they said, we're Tellarite. Are they going to beam up as Tellarites?
Right.
And would that be like the first time any Tellarite has come across a Tellarite-looking humanoid species? Have they beamed up as Andorian? I just didn't understand where they were going at here.
Or how about if Picard said, you know, what species are you? We're dogs. Good. Beam us aboard. And then when they beam up, fooled you. So, I don't know. Anyway, so Wesley is primming and pimping, primming himself and pimping Data for information. Meanwhile, that magnet in his bed, and I actually have that in my notes. Meanwhile, that magnet in his bed, you know, where he's been for the last 25 minutes doing God only knows what, still needs to get to engineering. So,
actually, so we are in Wesley's quarters here, right?
Yes.
So Wesley managed to get his superconducting magnet. He ran into the girl. He then rushed back to his quarters. Mm-hmm. He then called down Data, who at this point is in charge of the ship, right? He was left in charge by Picard and Riker.
Right.
I mean, who's running the ship at this point?
Ensign Gibson.
Well, perhaps. I was very surprised that, I mean, why would, you know, really, and I know that we discussed Data last week, and I know that Data is, you know, should be considered a sentient, you know, being with all the rights and responsibilities thereon, but at the same time, you don't just take him off duty because you want to have a chat in your bedroom after you've managed, you know, you managed to wander into a good-looking girl.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Commander Data, would you report to my quarters? You know, another side note for this. Do you think Wesley had to move out of his quarters when his mom moved?
Well, I hope he doesn't share them with Pulaski. That would be pretty hard.
Wesley's a man now before the end of season 2. Okay. The problem on Delid 4 is like the difference between night and day. That comes from Data. Even if
I hated that.
Really? Because I'll say, even if it's true, I wouldn't expect Data to use a colloquialism, but even by accident. So are we to believe this planet is in chaos because one half of the planet is always dark and the other half is always light? Why? I mean, a night person stumbles into the day zone, so they have problems, conflicts? I don't understand why.
There's the writer thought they were being clever of coming up with that line, and then they tricked you into a false sense of security in actually being, you know, true, quote-unquote, because there was a divide line between the dark side and the light side of the world. But I think it's stupid. Stupid, 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 stupid.
Yeah.
And also, by the end of it, right, you realize that these guys are basically light bulbs anyway. So, what? It didn't really, you know. Let's say that these people are like, you know, big energy people. Does it really matter the difference between light and day? I didn't get it.
Right. Good point. Okay. So Leah's talking to Anya, but Anya sure looks different now. She went from an old hag to a young hottie. And the girl that played her actually was runner-up for the role of Celia, too. So, But just as we're getting used to the young little hottie, she also turns into a hairy, clicky beast. What do you think of that little... I call it the little guy.
Okay, so this... I mean, this episode has a couple of... has a couple of special effects in it. I'm going to use the term relatively generously. So I'm talking about both the transformations and then also the monster outfits. I think that they are very kind of their time. I kind of knew that this was here, and I think that the kind of the makeup and the design of the creatures, and in particular the morphin scene, is particularly kind of Graydon, and it's very hasn't aged particularly well. But perhaps expecting it to be as bad as I remembered it, it didn't look as bad as I thought it was going to. So I thought it'd be one of these things I'd have a real big problem with, a bit like, you know, the Gorn suit or something. But in the end, I was happy to accept this little, this little kind of dirty Ewok or so running around the quarter.
Yeah, and she also plays one of either Janeway or Paris. Yeah, it was the transwarp human. They beam down and they phaser them and they bring them back to the ship, and and then little offspring come flowing out and going into the water. And you remember that one?
No, I do remember that one. I don't remember the little creatures. Actually, can I just point one thing I have on my note about the young Anya's dress or her costume? I don't know if it was kind of ripped down the front and ripped down the side of the legs. Don't tell me I'm the only person that noticed that.
Ripped down the side and ripped... I'm going to have to look at that.
So kind of down the front, it had a lot exposed, both down the front and down the legs. And it was kind of like a bit of a ripped look. And the only point that I was going to make is that it looked like that she had already gone a couple of rounds with that big kind of big creature that managed to beat up Worf a little bit later on in the episode. That the dress didn't have a large amount of structural integrity.
A little bit of show. Let me go ahead and keep talking while I kind of look that up on Google or something.
And I still think it's weird that Picard kind of Picard once they show the two women to their quarters, which they explicitly mentioned that these are Admiral's quarters. You're going to love these quarters. They're going to be great. And I can always leave that because I don't like when they keep mentioning how great the Enterprise is supposed to be, because the rooms don't actually look that great at all. But there's a bit where even Troy starts, she goes a bit opaque and she starts saying, well, it's not, I feel something strange. It's not that they, they're not who they say they are, but they don't feel like what they say they are.
So right.
What on earth are you talking about, Troy? I mean, Troy's been really good for a couple of episodes, and sometimes you get like this mumbo jumbo come out. And again, I think unfortunately Troy is perhaps the victim of poor writing in this episode in particular.
Could be.
And then what Picard does with that, right? He goes, well, I've got all the excuses I need to make a intimate Skype chat with this young lady that's just joined us downstairs in her bedroom. So, on viewer.
Yeah. Right into the teenage girl's room.
Indeed.
Mm. But of course Wesley wasn't there.
No, not quite yet.
Mm. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, they had like little rips on the side of her. I didn't see the front part, but... All right, gotcha. Okay. So, Wesley is in engineering looking for a defocused area, but he's completely defocused himself. Why? Because she's perfect. Absolutely perfect. Oops. Resonant field applied. So, now, have you ever applied a resonant field to, say, something like your car? I mean, I haven't. But, I mean, I could imagine, at one time, I think I may have accidentally applied a resonant field to my car, but it wasn't going to blow up or anything.
I mean, in fairness, it's a Are you criticizing the use of the word resonant field here?
Yeah.
Because I think in fairness, I think it's okay. So the idea is that if you were to apply something that happened to resonate at the same frequency as the underlying system, you would get things breaking.
Ah.
So that should be fine. I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Well, as long as a science guy says it's okay, I'm okay then. Okay, so
I do have to say, I like the, well, I don't like it at all, but yeah, you're right that, you know, Wesley's basically away with, you know, away with the fairies in this particular scene, and it gets to the point that even, you know, Geordi kicks him out of engineering pretty quickly, right? And then he goes to Geordi for a bit of love advice, and basically to disguise the fact that Geordi's basically not got a clue, he says, "Look, Wesley, I'm busy. Get out."
Yeah, if you ask somebody else. And that's what he does. On the bridge, in front of everybody who didn't turn and go, "What the hell was that?" We have Wesley trying to figure out how to pick up this girl. So he goes to Worf. And you roar loudly. But the women claw at you and throw heavy objects. While the man reads love poetry and ducks a lot. And I thought, what? Love poetry? Where the hell's that come from? In any other Klingon, like when Kalar comes on board, do you see Worf reading love poetry?
I mean, doesn't he try to quote stuff when they're in the holodeck together? Where he, I don't know whether it's poetry or whether it's just the ceremonial passages that he has to quote in order to get married. But I can't. By the way, I think this particular bit is probably the best part of the entire episode, and I think love poetry kind of fits into the Klingon male way of doing things. I don't know, I can easily see people like Martok and Worf reading love poetry.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to think of how that went. I remember at one point it was a Klingon G or something like that when, you know, she didn't want to take the oath with him, but. I don't recall any instance where I've ever seen a Klingon read love poetry. So I don't know if it was just something they tossed in but never tossed out again, but maybe and maybe not.
And can I hope that you're going to also mention the advice that Data gives to Wesley.
Oh, yeah. They are biologically compatible.
Well, it's actually the... And I think this is a good line to any single people out there. You know, this is a good line to use as a chat up line when you're trying to impress someone that you've noticed, which is, you know, judging by your appearance, it does appear that we're biologically compatible.
Yeah. Well, there could be a little difference in the histo-something compatibility or Data. I want to meet her, not dissect her. Okay.
Haven't said that.
Yeah. Yeah, that may be true, Wesley, but still, you never know where it's going to end up, so just be careful. All right. I mean, you've never heard a woman at Star Trek say, "Would you please get that thing out of my nose?" But I must be tunneling Paul there. I got to stop that. Okay, so no, Celia, you can't go on a tour. You will remain here where Wesley can come and get you and have his way with you. What do you think of Anya? I mean, do you want to punch her in the face, or maybe do you like her?
Actually, I didn't mind her at all. I thought that she was, I thought that she was okay. I thought that I kind of knew her motivation. I knew where she was coming from. She has to keep Celia safe, and the way, you know, despite being, you know, relatively an older woman who isn't physically very, you know, strong or. Doesn't appear to be, at least. She stands up to people, she stands up to Worf and you know, goodness me, also to Pulaski as well. And I think that she does her job well. And I think that by the end of it, certainly like the exchange that she and Worf has, I think is pretty well written. And I didn't mind her character at all. I think that the Celia character is much less... well developed. I didn't really know where she was coming from. So, and Anya's fine in my mind.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, she has to do her job, because will she be as effective as a leader if she's a teenage, a pregnant teenage girl? So, I don't know. Okay. So, what do I say? How do I act? All right, here we go. We're going to get to the bit between Riker and Guinan. And I just uploaded the last show. So by the time you guys hear this, you would have already heard Guinan and Picard do the whole slavery thing. So I did put that in for you, Doc, since you couldn't have heard it by now. So today I'm going to do that again. I like this bit between Riker and Guinan. It was awesome. I didn't like Wesley and his teenage snotty attitude while he was, you know, having to endure this. But yeah, let's take a listen to it. Okay. So, what do you think of the exchange? You are the most beautiful woman in the galaxy. But that might not work. Yes, yes it would. Ooh, boy, here we go.
I mean, I like it, and I think it's I think it's a bit of fun.
Right. So, here's...
I don't think it's like eye-rolling or painful or anything like that. I do honestly think it's a nice, you know, nice couple of minute scene in the episode.
And here's how it goes. This is what I've learned from that exchange between Riker and Guinan. Here's what we do. Okay, Riker, the smooth talker. Before we get to the pickup lines, first, we do like he did. We hold out a chair for the woman to sit down. Check. Then we go to our chair. We swing our leg over the top of the chair, thereby exposing things in your pajamas. And then tell a woman exactly... You know, it kind of tells the woman exactly what she's going to be getting from you. And if that's not realized by the woman, who kind of should see that as you're swinging your leg over, then we have some lines to use. And so Riker did it pretty good. I don't know. Anybody want to try that and see what happens? No one? No. Okay. Oh, somebody said yes. I just don't know who. So what do you think about Riker's sit-down stance?
Oh, it's always something to aspire to.
Yes. Yes. I would try something like that, but I don't know if I can get my leg that high. And even if I did, I'd probably fall over. Really be embarrassing, so I think I'll just sit down normal. Okay, so now the story heats up. Anya's checking engineering and finds LaForge is making routine adjustments on the deuterium. Really? Not supposed to do that. So she says that the defocused area can build excess pion production. You know, when you eat too much pie, and if you do that, you will explode, I guess. What do you think of that? I mean, what do you think Geordi was doing? You're the scientist. What's he saying about a minute defocused area?
I kind of think he's just talking about the engines not being 100% efficient and stuff. To me, it didn't sound like there was anything threatening or anything. I mean, I suppose, you know, when we mentioned at the beginning of the episode that he decided to do this now, I suppose, you know, the bad thing about it is that now Anya pops by and notices that there's a small issue and then starts, you know, getting upset and angry about it. But I really didn't, you know, I took this as just, you know, the engines needing a slight tune.
Okay.
That's all.
Okay, that's cool. But then we have Wesley taking a walk by Celia's quarters, who just happens to open the door at the right time and ask him to show her how to use a food dispenser. And what do you think of the guard outside making the "oh my god" face as he walks in?
Well, I have to say, I mentioned it right at the top of the show, but yeah. You know, that security guard, is he's a very well toned security guard for Next Generation. I mean, they usually look useless and, you know, like they've never been to a gym in their life.
Right.
And that guy seems like, you know, he works out.
Sure. But I think the fear, I think the look on his face was fear of the future coming of screams of joy that are going to be coming from her quarters. Oh, wait, guys, I'm talking about the Dalian chocolate mousse. You know, women love chocolate. So I'm sure that will... Oh, Wesley, this is terrific! Anyway. I never knew it would be so good. Chocolate mousse again. Talking about chocolate mousse.
Why do they have to put is it the Dalian in front of the chocolate mousse? Why not just call it chocolate mousse? Yeah. Do you ever refer to it as like German XYZ or Austrian something? Or you generally lose it, right? You're not going to say Chinese tea.
Hey, everybody, did you hear what he just said? Rewind your thing about, 30 seconds. Go ahead. Oh, you didn't hear it again? He said German XYZ. Huh. Fascinating.
There's nothing wrong with XYZ.
Yes, there is. It's amazing that one letter could actually be spoken as a word. Z-E-D. Z. That's amazing. But anyway. I can't go one call without insulting your entire way of life.
There are many letters that are words, right?
No.
I mean, how would you spell Q? You have to spell Q somehow. You'd need at least three letters to be able to spell out Q phonetically.
C U E, I suppose, yeah. Or Q U E U E Q. I mean, I suppose that's a word you guys use is Q, which is British for in line and waiting. I mean, we don't use the word Q here, unless you're.
Do you not?
No. It was used in telemarketing. You know, it was a Q line, but beyond that, no, you don't ever hear the word Q. Pool Q, you do.
So if you ask to, you know, where's the Q for, you know, whatever, an American would be confused.
Q? What's a Q? You mean the line? Yeah, the line is back here. The line starts here. The queue is way over there.
it is interesting because, I mean, slight tangent here, and I do apologize. I mean, it's a French word, by the way, queue. It comes from French. So it might just be that, you know, we've picked it up as part of a bit of a, you know, a British snobbish attitude, and the Americans didn't take it over with them.
It could be. But it doesn't matter. It's fine. Z is good. I have never met Z, but as far as I know, he's fine. Don't worry about it. Oh, and Thalian? Here, I even have this in my notes. On Thalius 7, that is, they aged the bean 400 years. And I thought, are you serious? Let's analyze that line. Okay, let's say I'm going to start a chocolate bean company. I plant the beans, wait until they cultivate, and then I age them for 400 years. So what he's saying is I have to wait over 400 years before I can even make my first sale. What would be the point of that? I'm hearing crickets now. Go on.
Well, I mean, from an economic perspective, you're going to demand a pretty high return on any of your capital that you invest in that farm. I kind of agree, but if they've been doing this for millennia, then you know you wouldn't have to plant the bean. You'll just harvest other beans that were planted 400, 500, 700 years ago, or what and whenever.
They aged the beans 400 years. I mean, that's unless they like. Keep burning it to make it look like it's been aged 400. I don't understand that part, but anyway. Andronesian encephalitis. Okay, again, he just has encephalitis. I don't even know what encephalitis is, let alone Andronesian.
But that's a really, really risky version of it.
Yeah, must be. Those Andronesians. They must be really promiscuous. Well, depending on what encephalitis is, I still don't know what it is. Do you?
No, not off the top of my head.
Okay. Well, anyway, Anya gives Pulaski an ultimatum. Kill the patient or she will. Then she turns into this very tall, hairy animal with very misaligned eyes. Do you happen to notice that?
Yes. Yeah. No, very clunky, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She gets a hold of Worf by the throat and Pulaski calls for security.
And Picard gets there before security gets there, which is, well, I hope that Picard happened to be walking by, rather than, you know, he is the first line of defense if Worf is off duty or taking someone around to visit the various areas. It's a bit weird, right, that you can actually walk into surgery being performed. I mean, you would imagine there was a little bit of privacy with the patients, rather than just allowing anyone to come in and, you know, to poke you. But the best thing about this particular scene is that, you know, when all is said and done, and when the big monster kind of reverts back into the old woman form, at that point, Worf seriously considers hitting the old lady with his fist, and I do enjoy that.
Yeah, the same.
I shouldn't, should I?
No, but, you know, yeah, Worf now wants to fight since it's just a little old lady now, and he tries to backhand her. Encephalitis is inflammation of the brain caused by infection or an allergic reaction. So that poor guy, Andronesian encephalitis, it's fascinating because I don't remember any missions to Andro or Andronesia or whatever. Okay, so what is Anya? She is an Alasimorph. But for all we know, she could be a changeling. So here's a question for you. And this is time for Doc Roberts' scientific lesson of the week.
Oh, dear.
It's going to be a good one, too. I think, no, you'll know. You'll know why. We've only charted 19% of our galaxy. Now, how can they determine that? How can they determine the size of something without charting the whole thing?
Well, we know how large the galaxy is now, right? So you know how large the galaxy is. When he says chart, I think all he means is that he's got, you know, they obviously know, they know the galaxy, they just don't know it particularly well. So there's like uncharted territory. You know, even in the older days when he went around the world and there'd be uncharted waters, but you would still know how big the Earth is. So when he just mentions chart, just consider that to be a well-defined, you know, we've been there or we have had first-hand reports of there or we've sent probes there. And everything else has just been, we've observed it through a telescope.
Okay. All right.
That's what I would think.
That makes sense. All right. And poor Wesley, you know, he's just doing his best. He finds a girl. He wants to settle down and have creatures with her. He's trying to get Salida to stay with him, and of course it won't work, because your language has no word for the position I'll hold. Really? I mean, there's no word for boss? Or, that, as you might say, how about gov?
I mean, to me, it also seemed like she was kind of going to fulfill a queen kind of role, right? I mean,
good point.
Is it a million miles away from a queen? You know, you're born to a family, you're raised until you've come of age, and then you take the throne. I mean, we've had that numerous times in our country.
So, I don't know. This is probably one of the scenes I really didn't like the most out of the whole episode, of her and Wesley talking and having more ice cream and 10 forward. And, of course, you know, you could stay. I just can't, and runs out of 10 forward, and Guinan has to say, you know, just because a girl runs out doesn't mean she doesn't wish you to follow. And we have this little bit in the corridor of two teenagers that, crying, and oh my goodness, I didn't, what do you think of that?
Let me just put in the proviso now that, you know, I'm a cynical old sod. And maybe I'm not the person that this has been aimed at. And maybe before I was more naive and would have loved this. But in my opinion, I mean, I think the Salida character is just horrible. Not horrible, but just extremely badly written. I actually don't know what her storyline is supposed to be. I don't know whether it's, you know, they're trying to mention about, you know, her being allowed to choose her own destiny. I don't know whether it's about her being confined. I don't know if it's about her learning to accept the duty that she has to take on. I don't know whether it's about her falling in love. I actually don't know what it's about from her storyline, because I don't think we really get that much. You know, we get a few moments of, ooh, I'm a little bit unsure. And then it turns into a, you know, there's nothing she wants more than to stay on the Enterprise and to, you know, what, following Wesley Crusher's footsteps, which seems to be going to work every morning, pressing a few buttons, and eventually falling out of the academy after not having performed well enough. Or so to me, I just didn't see, you know, the character isn't well written. It's not introducing the character with a conflict or really anything that I care about. So I really don't care. I don't care about the girl. Don't care about the holodeck. Don't care about the meat and chocolate. I just don't care.
Right.
I'm being really harsh, aren't I?
Well, it's just kind of the way we feel about it. I mean, it didn't do anything for me. But did you spot the very small bit of domestic violence that was involved in this? That did you see anything in their interaction in the corridor that may make you think maybe there was a little domestic violence?
No, I didn't. Maybe I feel bad now.
No, it's okay. It's so subtle that I never noticed it until I started doing this show, because now I look at it with a whole different eye. But as he says, you know, there's always a way. You know, you can do what you want to do. There is a way. And she says, for you, maybe. And then he just steps in, has this really weird look on his face. Is, you know, when he says there's a way, I know there is. And you actually see her jump back in startlement. And that's kind of what I thought. I don't know if anybody noticed that.
No, I didn't see that. And now here's the worst thing. I think directly following this, basically Geordi says that, hey, you know, we've got the warp drive back on. You know, let's put the pedal to the metal and, you know, get to the planet. And I looked at the time, and there's still a third of the episode to go. and actually, nothing happens for the remaining of the episode. I mean,
pretty much.
In fact, nothing happens at all. People come on board. They have a bit of a, you know, bit of a to and fro with various people. There's no B storyline. I actually think that the problem here is that the story is weak and it's stretched further than it can go. So you've now got a third of the runtime still left, and the best they're going to come up with, because there's no climax at the end of the show. There's nothing that needs to be solved. There's nothing else woven through in the same way that the child had the subplot about the bacteria or whatever. The only thing that's woven through now is that, you know, Celia ends up talking to Wesley in a happy mood. They then mention it. It then becomes apparent that Celia is also a changeling kind of person, and then Wesley gets annoyed. Right. And then you think, "What? Really? I really couldn't care about Wesley getting annoyed that he feels that the character somehow has betrayed him, because I didn't care about the character in the first place." So I don't know. I just don't see where this. This is bad.
It is. I know about it, you know. But, you know, the whole, you know, I want a friend. And Anya says, no. I raised you. It's like, I planted you. I cultivated you. And I intend to deliver you in a bouquet to Dalet Foa. Okay, what about Clofty and 3 and Dalet Foa having almost identical atmospheres? Do you think maybe they just ran out of money and couldn't develop a new planet?
Yeah, I do. Unfortunately, I do. I mean, I suppose to a certain extent you can claim that, you know, the people on Dalet 4 needed a similar kind of environment to live. Mm-hmm. And so they went to a place. No one's going to leave, you know, no one's going to leave a tropical paradise and then move to a horrendous planet full of volcanoes and stuff. So, you know, in a way it's okay. But I think that the fact that they specifically mention it, to me, is just hiding the fact that they're using the same visual effects for both planets.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, this obviously, wasn't this during the writer's strike?
Oh, yes. I mean, this would have been, we're well into the territory of this would have been, this particular year has affected it on the whole in general. And you can kind of, well, maybe that's, you know, maybe that's the reason why this, it seemed thin, it seemed overstretched.
And then, of course, we've got Wesley's first kiss. Until, of course, the beast comes running in. And I'm talking about Anya, not Wesley. But, you know, it's a poor thing. I mean, he was getting all excited and kind of in the mood till Anya comes running in and
But the thing is, actually, when I watched this for this show, because I probably watched it 3 years ago, so it's not been that long. But when Celia comes in and she's really like giggly and, you know, excited, I actually thought that there was Anya pretending to be Celia. And I'm sure that's happened on Trek at a certain point. But I thought that was what was happening. And she was almost like entrapping Wesley. And I thought, okay, you know, that's predictable. But it wasn't even that. It was simply that she escaped. Anya ran after her. They both turned into monsters. They just stood next to each other, right, and made a bit of noise. And then Wesley gets annoyed about it. And I don't know. I just don't really care for it at this point.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about the communication from Dalet 4.
Oh, please.
We could get off there, because there's another little lesson we could learn. It originated from a terawatt source, which Riker says is more than the Enterprise can generate. So I thought, terawatt. I looked it up and I thought, isn't that 1 trillion watts?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a trillion, but it would be. Yeah, it's just the same as whatever you need to do to a terabyte. It's the same as a watt. But I don't think a terawatt is that large, by the way. I mean, I really don't. I don't think it's that large. I don't know exactly what kind of energy is used in the city, but I don't think Terra is that large, certainly like for spaceships and things.
Well, I went to Google and I said, you know, how many watts in 1 terawatt? And it gave me a 1 with 3, 6, 9, 12 zeros. So I'm thinking 1,000, 100,000, million, billion, has to be a trillion. So most likely 1 trillion watts. And then I thought, well, how much did the space shuttle require, since we know that's an actual vehicle? And the space shuttle required 12 billion watts to run. So the Enterprise has the power of 83 shuttles. And if Dalet 4's radio is the same as 83 space shuttle launches, I don't know if I'd want to be standing next to that transmitter. Do you think I'd be vaporized with the radiation?
Well, okay, I think there are two things. I think that the transmission itself seems to be overpowered, but I also think that the Enterprise is underpowered for what the Enterprise is. So yes, you wouldn't want to be standing near it, but also at the same time, you wouldn't want to, you know, you would expect a starship to have more power. By the way, I have just looked up what the energy demand for London is.
Okay.
So London is it's around 50 gigawatts.
Okay.
So that means 200 Londons is a terawatt. But surely you'd expect a city in the sky that can go at warp to be of that, right? Or am I just crazy?
200 Londons?
Yeah, I would have thought so. I would have thought we're talking about, you know, almost unlimited power. I'm sure that the Enterprise should be able to have more than a terawatt worth of power.
You know, I gotta ask you in a tangent, since you brought up London. I'm going to ask about London. What is the deal with the structural integrity of London bridges? Because as far as I know, since I was a kid, they're always falling down.
Yeah. Really?
Yes. Do you want me to sing it to you?
No. Are you aware that there's an often repeated story? Because the London Bridge, so there are many bridges over the Thames in London, and there is one that's specifically called London Bridge. And London Bridge, there's a story that gets repeated a lot in the UK, because we like to, we basically like to portray the Americans as being stupid. So there's a story that goes around that we actually sold the old London Bridge to an American, in an American city. And so they picked up London Bridge and they flew it over, and then he put it up in somewhere in North America. Actually, I don't know where. And the story that goes around is that, so the most famous London Bridge is Tower Bridge. So the one with the big towers and the one that opens up in the middle. And London Bridge itself is a very ordinary bridge. And the story that goes around is that when the Americans got London Bridge, quote unquote, back to their place, they realized that A, it wasn't Tower Bridge that they thought they were buying, and B, it was like 400 meters longer than they thought it was, because they thought they were buying the Tower Bridge. So everything that I've just said there is often repeated in the UK, but is actually not true. We did sell London Bridge, but they did know they were buying London Bridge at the time.
Okay. Talk about a stupid tangent, Lou. Anyway, but yeah.
And it's not falling down anymore.
No?
London Bridge is fine. No. Although, having said that, around 2 years ago, a boat managed to crash into one of the bridges further up the river. I believe it was Bermondsey. It would have been further up again, so things like Battersea, maybe. And that knocked out a bridge for you to be able to go across it for, I think, 9 months or so.
Well, maybe the guy at the helm of that boat was fiddling around with his fair lady. I don't know. Anyway.
Okay, getting back to the episode, right?
Well, I thought you'd want to get off the episode. Go on.
So they receive a message from the planet. It needs a terawatt of power to be sent. They can't send the signal back, but they can beam them down?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so you can't send a signal back, but you can beam them down. That makes no sense at all.
Mm-mm.
I mean, beaming down isn't like, you know, it makes it sound, this episode makes it sound like beaming them down is like, you know, put them into a box and throwing them down to the ground. It's, you need to be able to have a signal sent at least in order to be beamed down. Otherwise, you're not going to have any control about where they materialize and everything. To me, that seemed very silly.
That's true. I never thought of that. And what about the chocolate she gets a little lick of while she's on the transporter pad? When she turns to light, shouldn't she have a little dark smudge and say wherever her stomach would be?
Oh, when she turns to the light bulb.
Yeah. Should have a little dark smudge where the chocolate is working its way through her digestive tract. I don't know. Okay. Okay, so anyway, we get to our last scene because we really need to. The scene between Riker and Guinan was fun. This one was kind of sad. Wesley's in 10 forward with laughing all around him, and he just wants to die. So Guinan comes over to his table and tells a story about how looking at her was looking at pure light, and how he's never going to feel this way again, to which Guinan agrees. It'll be different every time. It will always be different. What do you think of this last scene?
I'd actually had given up by this point.
Really?
I think the little coda at the end is I think it's fine. I think it's, I don't think it's anything earth shattering. I think it's a couple of nice minutes with Whoopi Goldberg. I think the main problem I have is I just don't
care anymore.
I mean, I don't care about Wesley, and also we didn't mention that Wesley gets annoyed and then, you know, thinks, well, I'm annoyed with her because she actually turned out to be a changeling, and apparently that's something to be upset about. And then he manages to get into the transporter room just before she goes down and you almost say forgives her, which I don't think he needs, forgives her. I mean, let's just put it on record. She's way out of his league.
Yeah.
And he's acting a bit like a spoiled little boy here. So there's no, he forgiven her going on there. There really isn't.
Well,
I think she's way better than this, and she really should have kicked him out of the transporter room.
You need to leave now. Okay. Well, we did also glaze over the fact that he thought he was in love with her, and he told her he loved her, and she said, I love you too. And I thought, oh, good God. These two met each other, 7 hours ago? Obviously. Yeah,
unless Geordi really took a really long time to fix that warp drive. And then also, something I do have in my notes, and I thought I wasn't going to have an opportunity to bring it up, but now I do, is that a little advice there for any like single guys out there. So if a woman ever turns around and says, oh, I love you too, you do not respond by saying, can you? I mean, come on. And then she takes that and says, yes, of course I do. Absolutely. Anything. Come off it.
Yeah.
I would have stabbed him through the eye at that point.
Right. All right. Well, unless you have anything else to dissect.
I'm not the biggest fan of this episode.
I guess not. But I do like the last scene, and I'll give you a hint already. Guinan actually, the bits with Guinan, and especially the last one, when she tries to pretty much soothe his broken heart, that gave it an extra point. But don't worry, it's still not any higher than you would think. So it's time for our final thoughts and ratings on a scale of 1 to 2, which... Okay. Oh, okay. Make that 1 to 5. With 1 being where it really is and 2 being very generous. I mean, 5 being the best. Okay. I'm just not into teenage love sagas. Celia was a very cute girl, which is why Wesley fell for her. Had she been a teenage blob of gel, well, I doubt he would have felt the same. Her human form was perfect. Even when she walked down the corridor, her butt wiggled just like it should. Although, kind of a big butt there on that girl, but I don't care. Doesn't matter. Anya and Worf had some pretty great moments. Who is the stronger beast? Well, we'll never find out because he's going to fight with her instead of against her. Actually, I think she would have ripped him a new one. And then after she'd done that, she'd rip the new one a new one. Puppy dog love story. Well, it goes back to my desire to watch teenage love stories and glaring hormones in action. Actually, I've never had a desire to watch them, even when I was just a little bit older than the characters were when this first came out. I do, however, like Guinan's interaction with Riker, especially when she's there, and then later when she's there to soothe Wesley's broken heart. That might be a chore for his mother, but since she wasn't there, Guinan will do. Guinan did terrific, and we didn't even talk about this. Whenever Guinan performs, I usually go for it. So now, if Counselor Troy had been there to make him feel better, would it have been the same? So really, I think the writers realize Whoopi beats Marina all to hell. Deanna can just keep the headaches, you know, keep reporting headaches, and the fact she reports the glaring obvious, such as a Romulan ship firing on the Enterprise, is angry with us. But when it comes to heart and soul parts, give me more Guinan. In fact, I said before, Guinan gives the story an extra point. It wasn't quite the middle of the road, and if Guinan weren't in this, we'd be driving on the wrong side of the road like they do in England. But since Guinan is here to keep us in the right lane, because of that, I actually am going to give this a 3. Because of Guinan, or else it would have gotten 2.
What? Okay.
I like little Guinan bits. It's the only thing I really like about it. Otherwise, it would have probably left it a 2. It wasn't the most terrible thing that we've seen on Star Trek. But it didn't deserve a 3 in its own right. Guinan gave this an extra point.
Okay. Well, in my mind, I just don't care about this story. I don't think the Celia character comes on with anything that you can relate to. So there is probably a decent story you can put across this, you know, this person being put into a difficult position and, you know, questioning, you know, what she wants out in life and stuff. But they just don't really touch that, and they just end up. To me, it's just very, very, very clunky and very much... I really don't care for the characters involved, certainly the Wesley. I mean, I'm not a big hater of Wesley by any means, but I just didn't think that there was any reason for these guys to be so madly in love with each other. And in particular, the way that Wesley behaves afterwards when he finds out that she's a shapeshifter, I just really have lost patience by that point. I also think it's, you know, the story doesn't have a B-plot. So it is far too thin to stretch across for, you know, 45 minutes. So it doesn't, you know, it really does let itself down in that respect. I thought the, you know, I'm not going to attack things like, you know, the special effects aren't particularly good and whatnot. I'm just going to say that as a story, I was bored and I didn't really like it. I think Guinan is good, and Guinan's good in a lot of stuff. Guinan was also in. She was also in. What's the episode with the when Data learns humor?
Oh yeah,
the outrageous Locona. Yeah. You know, she was good in that as well. She was, well, maybe she wasn't necessarily good, but she was in it. And I do apologize, but I can't give this more than a one.
Ooh, one. Yes. And you know
what have I given a one this year? It's been Outrageous Icona and this, I believe.
You want to hear something funny?
Go ahead.
My microphone, for some reason, picks up just about every breath I make. So sometimes when I'm doing the edits, I generally take out those sounds so it doesn't distract from when others are talking. But when you just did your final thought and rating, I was smirking and laughing pretty much the whole time. And you know why? I don't know if anybody caught this, but this is exactly what you felt today was exactly what I was going through for Home Soil.
With Home Soil, I know. I know. I'd realized that as I was watching the episode. I was thinking, you know, I was actually bored and I was thinking, like, I don't care about this and this isn't going fast enough. And I did make the point, you're two-thirds of the way through the episode and effectively everything's resolved other than, you know, Wesley having a hissy fit. And I don't have 15 minutes of my life that I can dedicate to watching Wesley have a hissy fit. And I thought, Lou must have thought of this when he was watching Home Soil.
Yes, it just was all mind-numbing. But, okay.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Destroy that probe!
An alien force is programming the Enterprise for self-destruction.
We're sitting on a bomb that could go off any second.
Leaving the ship defenseless against an enemy attack.
They're preparing to fire photon torpedoes.
Sir, the shields aren't responding.
No, the crew faces a countdown to disaster on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
So, why don't you join us next week as we review a much better episode. Well, that's subjective. It's episode 11 of season 2, and that would be Contagion. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London. And thank you for listening, and good night, everyone.
Good night. 400 years, you're going to age the beans. Yeah.
It was written by Scott Rubenstein and Leonard Mlodinow. Oh, I had that one. I had that one all the way.
Mlodinow?
Mlodinow. It's because... Bloody blimey. Because I, do you know what the problem is? The problem is on my notes, I have left the middle I. It's Mlodinow. Mlodinow is a fine, absolutely fine. I'm going to go again.
Uh-huh.
Mlodinow.
Actually, I would start it written by.
No, indeed. Indeed.
Surely he'd been in such situations before. Being a mediator, he should have made allowances for others unfamiliarity with the form of communication.